From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Today we remember Robin Williams. He died yesterday at 63. Terry interviewed Williams in 2006 and talked about his life, movies, and comedy. He began doing stand-up in the 70s.
Who were you then? Like, what was your style on stage, like, before
I was still Robin Williams. Early on, I realized that I didn't need to use a mic, but having been trained at Juilliard, I could enunciate and be off stage.
Williams also discussed his manic performance style and if he ever felt depression.
Do I perform sometimes in a manic style? Yes. Am I manic all the time? No. Do I get sad? Oh, yeah. Does it hit me hard? Oh, yeah. But does that immediately make me like, oh, good, thanks for asking that, Terry, because, yeah, I get depressed, you know. No, I get bummed, like I think a lot of us do at certain times.
Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews the novel Dear Committee Members, which Maureen calls a minor masterpiece. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. We were all stunned yesterday by the news that comedian and actor Robin Williams was found dead in his home in California. Williams had struggled with depression and with cocaine and alcohol addiction. The Marin County Sheriff's Office said his death appears to be a suicide. He was 63. Today we'll listen to Terry's interview with Robin Williams. He was born in Chicago and studied acting at the Juilliard School. He got a breakout TV role in the sitcom Mork and Mindy and soon became known as a brilliant comedian, mixing manic improvisation with rapid-fire impersonations. In 1997, Entertainment Weekly dubbed him the funniest man alive. Williams had a long film career, playing both comedic and dramatic roles. Among his films are The World According to Garp, Good Morning Vietnam, Dead Poets Society, The Fisher King, Aladdin, Mrs. Doubtfire, One Hour Photo, and Good Will Hunting, for which he won an Oscar. He briefly returned to television last year, starring in the short-lived CBS sitcom The Crazy Ones. Terry spoke to Robin Williams in 2006.
Robin Williams, welcome to Fresh Air. You've played a couple of psychologists. I mean, you played the neurologist Oliver Sacks, and you played a psychologist.
Yeah, he was a very good friend, and it's...
Yeah, and Good Will Hunting. But I'm wondering if you see yourself as a psychologist in a way as an actor, because, I mean, what you have to do is really get into somebody's mind when you act.
And it helps to read about all that, like, and even doing a character like Perry in... The Fisher King, you have to really kind of go through and read all the documentation and look at the tapes and the things of post-traumatic stress. And there's a lot of, yeah, as an actor, you get to explore all sorts of behavior, some of it aberrant and some of it normal and some of it, you know, quite unusual. And it helps and to be aware of that and to observe that and to bring as much detail as possible.
I mean, one of the things you're famous for is always having like 100 people inside of you, and often when...
Oh, that is very strange. Why do you bring this up?
Precisely.
Like, my point, for me, it's crazy to do this on radio, American radio, you know, after I find it difficult to do. But
But here's what I'm wondering. Since you always seem to be traveling with a... The coterie
of people
inside of you, exactly.
It's a cheap posse.
If there's always, whenever you do a character, in a movie, if you feel they always have a counterpart inside of you someplace.
No, I don't know if they always have a counterpart. I think they, maybe afterwards you find that. But I don't carry the characters around when I'm doing the movie because it can be quite frightening for your family to come home as those people.
Yeah, I'll bet.
I did that one time with the movie The Secret Agent, and I came home. In the Secret Agent, it's basically a character that was admired by Theodore Kaczynski, which is some fan mail you don't really want to open.
Oh, yeah.
But that this is a man who is a chemist and specializes in making bombs and despises humanity. And I was kind of thinking about the character, and my wife said, stop. Because you get that very kind of dead-eyed look, like, I really don't want to be here. No, I mean the planet, not just this room. And it frightened her, and I didn't want to do that to my family.
You know, you obviously like improvisation a lot. What's it like for you when you're doing a movie where you're supposed to be following the script, and you are following the script? Do you find restricting, or do you like that discipline?
I like the discipline because, you know, it forces you to kind of... years ago, I was doing The World According to Garp, and I improvised. And I started off just improvising like crazy, and George Roy Hill made a face like a weasel in a wind tunnel. And then I went, just say the words. And it really helped to, you know, focus, put all of yourself into that, and also be freed up by that and find the behavior with that. And occasionally you can improvise, use that as a base and go off from it. But if a script is well written, you realize you don't have to, like with Good Will Hunting. Very little riffing there because it was such a precise piece that you didn't need to.
Well, you mentioned Good Will Hunting. Why don't we hear a scene from Good Will Hunting?
Sure.
This is a clip where you play a psychologist who whose wife has died, and
right.
There's a hole at the center of your life, and you're counseling a kind of working class kid who is actually quite brilliant in terms of math, even though he's only working at the university in a kind of janitorial position, and you're actually both helping each other in this therapy relationship because he's bringing you more in touch with your feelings, and you're kind of counseling
it's pretty
him.
Symbiotic in what yeah, we're doing, yeah. and it kind of builds off both, and it's, you know, almost parental in that way. And
yeah, and yeah, he's there's a relationship he may or may not be building with a girl, and you're trying to encourage mm-hmm. him to move forward on that. So, anyways, let's hear the scene.
I went on a date last week.
How'd it go?
It was good.
You going out again?
I don't know.
Why not?
I haven't called her.
Christ, you're an amateur.
I know what I'm doing. Yeah. Don't worry about me. I know what I'm doing. Yeah, but this girl is, like, you know, beautiful. She's smart. She's fun. It's different from most of the girls I've been with.
So call her up, Romeo.
Why? So I can realize she's not that smart, that she's f***ing boring? You know, I mean, you don't... This girl's, like, f***ing perfect right now. I don't want to ruin that.
Maybe you're perfect right now. Maybe you don't want to ruin that. But I think that's a super philosophy, Will. That way you can go through your entire life without ever having to really know anybody. My wife used to fart when she was nervous.
She had all sorts of wonderful little idiosyncrasies. You know, she used to fart in her sleep. One night it was so loud it woke the dog up. She woke up and go like, oh, was that you? See, I didn't have the heart to tell her. Oh, God.
She woke herself up, yes.
Oh, Christ. But Will, she's been dead 2 years, and that's the shit I remember. It's wonderful stuff, you know? Little things like that.
Yeah, but those are the things I miss the most. The little idiosyncrasies that only I knew about. That's what made her my wife. Oh, and she had the goods on me, too. She knew all my little peccadilloes. People call these things imperfections, but they're not. Oh, that's the good stuff. And then we get to choose who we let into our weird little worlds.
That's Robin mm-hmm. Williams and Matt Damon in a scene from Good Will Hunting. That's the movie you won the Academy Award for.
Right.
Did it seem like a stretch for you to do the movie?
No, I mean, I was just excited that they offered it. I mean, when I read it, I went, this is a piece that has such depth. And when I met the boys, I went, okay, you know, and then they actually took flack for it because people thought they didn't write it, but they did. And you realize it's based on, you know, family members, like Matt's mother is a developmental psychologist and Ben's father is a bit like the character, Matt's character, this, you know, kind of maverick genius who went to MIT and then ended up working at a theater company with Robert Duvall and Dustin Hoffman. So all this stuff was part of it, and no, it wasn't a stretch. It was just a great exploration, and the idea of playing a psychiatrist, but also a guy who's led, you know, who's coming out of it. I mean, who's the loss of his wife pretty much knocked him on his ass and set him back drinking, and kind of, you know, and then coming back to deal with this boy who is brilliant, you know, intellectually, you know, far outstretching everybody else, but emotionally really blocked, and you know, is a victim of a lot of. You know, not necessarily, physical abuse. And you realize taking him through that, walking him through that, in a weird way, pulls me back, too. I'd given up, you know, I was teaching, but I wasn't really practicing as a therapist.
You did a trilogy of recent films in which you were bad guys or very troubled. Two of them were dramas, One Hour Photo and Insomnia, and one was a comedy, Death to Smoochie.
Right.
I'm wondering, if was that a conscious choice on your part to head to the darker
side? It was unconscious at the time to realize.
Yeah.
To go that way, come to the darker side, Robin.
It was they just came, and I thought, these are interesting. I'd never had a chance to play them before. And especially with Insomnia, to work with Pacino. Hoo-ha! That was a...
I don't know, Robin. It's weird. Good. How was that take? It was wonderful. They went rolling. That's good.
But to work with him was the gift, and Insomnia was the idea of playing this kind of a psychopath, and the idea of someone who tries to win you over. I mean, the sociopath-psychopath double bill was fascinating for me to explore that type of behavior and not have to do time.
Right.
And also with One Hour Photo, that a lot more people seem to be deeply disturbed by that, about the access to their private life through, you know, their photographs. Which, you know, it's weird because now a lot of those labs are closing out as digital cameras take over. But every person I talked to who worked at a lab said they all had a wall of shame where they had duplicated weird photos of grandma in a thong and put them on the wall. And it was like, come over here, Bob, look at these. And that's, you know, the truth about the situation. You get, you know, people were very disturbed by that.
Yeah, it was. I really liked your performance in this movie, and you played somebody who runs one of those one-hour photo booths in like a big like drugstore kind of store.
Yeah, and one of those big kind of mall outlet stores where the lighting is so bright, even, you know.
And your life is so kind of empty in it that
very
you
much.
Become totally involved in the lives of, you know, of the people whose photos you develop, particularly
he basically
this one family
is,
and their family photos.
Family by proxy, and he tracks their life through their photos, and he thinks of himself as part of the family. And it's that thing of when you see the news of, oh, they have this, they'll show somebody who snaps, and they'll go, he always seems so regular. And you go, what's that guy like? And that loneliness and that idea to live another life by, you know, by proxy, by photograph, you know?
Robin Williams speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 2006. We'll hear more in a moment. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and we're listening to Terry's 2006 interview with Robin Williams, who died yesterday at the age of 63.
Was the kind of improvisational, eccentric humor that made you famous ever considered a problem? And here's what I'm asking, but here's what I mean by that. Did you behave in that kind of way with a lot of like zany characters popping out from you when you were young, at times that were considered inappropriate, like
not
in
at
school?
All. I was very
quiet.
No. In school, I was very quiet and very kind of, you know, I went to an all-boys private school for high school and then went to a public high school in San Francisco in 1969. It was like the yin and yang of education. So I never really started to even be funny openly on that level. I mean, I was a closet comedian for so many years. And the idea of finally just letting it out was in the senior year of high school, where they had like a play where you could make fun of everything. And that was the first time I really had a performance. I was serious about a student, as serious a student as you could be, you know, cum laude society and the whole thing, and an athlete. So it was all kind of, you know, go ahead. And I remember the motto of my private school was mens sano in corpore sano, in sound mind and sound body. It's a bit like the school in Dead Poets Society. And I was one of the students going, yes, you know, and then... Luckily, I had a few teachers, a history teacher who told me that, you know, history is one of the great black comedies of all time. It's just on who's writing it. And all of a sudden I went, wait a minute, I can use these skills. And then when I went to college, that's where it really came out big time, and a chance to perform in an improv theater company, mainly to meet girls. As you find out from a lot of people, when I talked to Rod Steiger years ago, he said, I went to an acting class, not necessarily to act, but to meet women. But you get the idea that, you know, it started then, but no, they weren't, and it still isn't. I mean, a woman came up to me in an airport one time and said, be zany. I went, pardon? Be zany. So, I mean, it's that thing they want you to kind of, you know, be that thing, and it's like, no, you know, sometimes it's fun and I'll play if the moment's right. If it's like, you know, if there's an opportunity, yeah, and if not, I'll talk straight with you. We can talk about that. It'd be cool.
So do you think of yourself when you were younger as having been quiet or inhibited or both?
Quiet and inhibited both, yeah, I think, yeah. No, I think I was just learning and quiet. I'm an only child, so it was like, you know, going, okay, let's just learn where we are now. And moving back and forth between Detroit and Chicago, and you make a group of friends, sorry, lose those, moving over here now. And so you learn to kind of adapt, and you take your time. You kind of work the room slowly.
It sounds like you really went from one extreme to the other. From inhibited to, you know, incredibly uninhibited, yeah.
Yes, very much, as Oliver Sacks says, voluntary Tourette's, you know, you just this side of Ann Coulter, you know. You're, except it's occasionally I get a laugh, you know. You know, they're actually using her saliva now as an anti-venom. A lot of people go, I was bitten by a cobra. Here we have some of Ann Coulter's saliva. Even the cobra's going, wow, she's effective.
No. Before this, did you know that you had a gift as a mimic, that you could do voices and accents?
A little bit. I mean, I used to, for my mother, I could play my grandmother, which would, even Freud would go, don't do that. Be very careful when you imitate the relatives who are nearby.
And I would do my grandmother, oh, sonny boy, how y'all? I'm down here just sitting in Memphis watching wrestling in a teddy. And my mother would be like, oh, that's wonderful to stop. But, you know, that was the first kind of, you know, playfulness and imitating. You know, you always start imitating family members, and it was pretty cool.
What kind of roles were you cast in college? We're talking Juilliard.
Oh, Juilliard, all different types of roles. I remember we did a production of Midsummer Night's Dream, and I was one of the rustics, you know, the guys who are, you know, the union guys in the middle of the Shakespeare play. You know, they're there doing their play, and I also played a fairy, which was and a dancer. Pease Blossom and Hausman, I remember seeing him laugh big time, which was like watching Buddha blow up. So it was pretty wonderful. And then we played all different roles, you know, from Tennessee Williams, Night of the Iguana. I played an old character. And it was, you know, you do the whole gamut. But that was also where I started to play a little bit more and, you know, realized that I'm more of a character comedian than the leading man, who I went to school with, you know, Chris Reeves and a lot of people, Bill Hurt, Mandy Patinkin, they were all there at the time. And, you know, hardcore. You know, intense actors, and I'm like, oh, that's cool, but I'd rather play.
Now, how did that lead to comedy?
I think it led to comedy as a survival mechanism, especially when I left school and went back to San Francisco and couldn't find acting work and saw this thing, like it said comedy workshop, and I went, it's like syntax repair. Interesting. So I went to this workshop in the basement of a Lutheran church and started, it was stand-up comedy, so you don't get to improvise with others, but I started off doing ostensibly just, it was like improvising but solo. And then it started to realize, oh, I'm building an act from there. And then you went from the workshop to actually clubs, which at that time were usually music or folk music clubs that put comedy on as almost like, you know, interstitials in between the acts. And it was pretty wild. I mean, even the workshop, we have comedy night after they had an evening of lesbian poetry, which brings in a really interesting audience for comedy. Especially if you're a male stand-up, and it starts to, it builds up, you know, you with your big violence, thank you, and please welcome. And it was kind of fun to see that builds up. And performing comedy in San Francisco to begin with is pretty wild. You know, you've got the human game preserve to play off of, you know. And it's a lot of great characters everywhere. And you work off that, and then you play the rooms, and eventually you get to a point where you're playing a club that is a comedy club with other comics, and it's like, oh, now you're among your brethren.
You got started doing stand-up comedy in, the 70s probably, right, or 80s?
Yeah, the 70s, mid to late 70s, yeah.
So it's kind of like the early days of the whole comedy boom, so...
Yeah, it was like the revival, and it's like it started off kind of small and like little clubs that were like ostensibly usually music clubs that would have comedy, and then later on, when I went to New York and stuff, there were literally like the comedy clubs, like the Improv, and then L.A., the Comedy Store. But yeah,
who were you then? Like, what was your style on stage? Like before,
I was
more
still Robin Williams, but the style was just kind of. Early on, I realized that I didn't need to use a mic, but having been trained at Juilliard, I could enunciate and be off stage, and it kind of freed me up to work the audience and kind of. It was more like an anti-heckler defense, because if someone said something, I could come out in the audience and they're going, what are you doing out here? I know where you live. And that you could kind of change perspectives and kind of keep it going. First time I did a paying gig was at a club in Orange County called the Laugh Stop. And the whole sound system blew out. And so all of a sudden they said, go on. I went up there, and because I didn't need a mic to begin with, I just worked the crowd and kind of till they got the sound system back up. And it really kind of helped build a style that was more like, use anything, anywhere, and with the improv background, if anyone said anything, to go off on it. Like one time in a New York club, some woman yelled out, Dr. Roof. She was trying to say Dr. Ruth, but she'd had 5 gin and tonics. And I started doing Dr. Roof, who was like a black sex therapist. Mm-hmm. And you could start, mm-hmm. Man say foreplay, mm-hmm. You not done, mm-mm. You know, protection, mm-mm. Get away from me, that's my protection. Straight edge razor, mm-hmm. But it was all part of, you know, building a style that was pretty loose. And then later on, you would start to put structure to it. By the time I did Night at the Met, it was pretty, it started to have like a flow and kind of a structure. But up till then, it was pretty, pretty free form.
Robin Williams speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 2006. We'll hear more of their conversation in the second half of the show. Williams died yesterday at the age of 63. Here's Williams singing the song Friend Like Me from the Disney film Aladdin. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Sherry's already had 1,000 tales. Master, you in luck, cause up your sleeves you got a brand of magic never fails. You got some power in your corner now. It's heavy ammunition in your camp. You got some punch, pizzazz. You got who and how. See, all you gotta do is rub that lamp. And I'll say, Mr. Lancer, what will your pleasure be? Let me take your order, jot it down. You ain't never had a friend like me. Life is your restaurant, and I'm your manager. Come on, whisper what it is you want. You ain't never had a friend like me.
Yes, sir. We pride ourselves on service.
You're the boss, the king, the shine. Say what you wish, it's yours. True dish about a little more baklava. Add some of column A, try all of column B. I'm in the mood to help you, dude. You ain't never had a friend like me. No, no. Can your friends do this? Can your friends do that? Can your friends pull this off their little hat? Can your friends go poo?
Hey, look at here.
Can your friends go abracadabra? Let it rip! And then make the sucker disappear. So don't you sit there, smack your buggy eye. Answer all your business prayers. You got me bona fide, certified. You got a genie for a child to pay.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Anchor Bay Entertainment with The Railway Man, based on the autobiography of Eric Lomax, starring Colin Firth and Nicole Kidman. On Blu-ray and DVD. From eSurance, with Coverage Counselor, a car insurance tool for helping customers select coverage limits at eSurance.com. And from Angie's List, offering consumer reviews for more than 19 years and providing online shopping and scheduling for local services. Angie'sList.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, we continue our 2006 interview with Robin Williams, who died yesterday in an apparent suicide. He was 63. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the funny new novel about academia, Dear Committee Members. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. Today we're listening to Terry's 2006 interview with Robin Williams, who died yesterday at the age of 63. Williams was a one-of-a-kind comedian who also had a long career in film, playing both comic and dramatic roles. He won an Oscar for Good Will Hunting.
I know you've done performances in Afghanistan and Iraq for
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. When you perform there, it's... When you're on stage and everybody's fully armed and in body armor, I guess I didn't get that memo. And you realize you better be funny because they're strapped. And performing in Afghanistan the first time, because I wasn't going with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, so it was pretty much on our nickel, was pretty wild and great audiences. And it, You know, you land there the first time and you're met by people who look like Spider-Man on a day pass, full night vision goggles and, you know, jalaba. My favorite people to perform for are the Special Forces guys who are dressed in full Afghani kit except for the New York Yankees hat. And that was always, they're the ones with the light sticks going, dude! But yeah, I performed there 3 times in Afghanistan, twice in Iraq. I'll go back. I mean, this year I missed it because I was working, but you don't get a better audience, and it's good to go there and bring other people.
What kind of material seemed most appropriate for entertaining our
troops? Materials for them, they don't censor me in terms of, you know, there's the blue factor. I mean, they just want to have a good time, so you can be, you know, pretty much let me do anything I could do on HBO. I mean, the political stuff, sometimes, you know, you can try stuff because we went to one National Guard base, and that was the time when they were revealing that the Hummers were about as well-armored as a Prius, and talked about putting Don Rumsfeld on the front, strapped down like in Road Warrior, and just, humongous, bring them to me, and just see how that would affect the Iraqis. Just the fact, or put Cheney there and just took up his pacemaker to jumpstart some of the Hummers.
And you said that, and you weren't criticized for it?
Not by them, because they were living it. They were living the dream, baby. You know, you get picked up in a Hummer that goes, did you just strap that stuff on? Yes, Mr. Williams, it's part of it. But you do stuff for them, you know, like meals, MRE, meals ready to excrete. They're basically, you go to Afghanistan and you swallow enough dust that you'll pass an adobe brick. But that's all part of it. You talk about that, and, you know, you see a lot. You meet a lot of amazing people.
Did the troops there want to know what your position on the war was, and did you want to let
on at
all?
No, they knew. I mean, they know that I'm not, you know, and they know what my position on the administration is, you know, that the great decider. I'm the decider. No, you make decisions. The decider is what they serve. They serve decider down with the apples in Maine. Yep, right there. But they know where I'm at with that. They know I came there to perform for them. It isn't like, with the war, you want to go, oh, man, you know. With Afghanistan, you see that they've tried to really make a difference and, you know, build it from the ground up and create, you know, like when you see when the elections occur, people really do want to vote and get out and, you know. It's, and at one point when the Iraqis were writing the Constitution, I said, take ours, we're not using it. But it's, and you remember when the Iraqis were coming here and... They go, what amendment, commandment, explain to me the difference. But they know, and you're there, and saying, hey, dude, it's not about the politics, it's about you.
Would you have been surprised if somebody told you in the late 1960s, in the Vietnam era, that you would be entertaining troops in the 2000s?
Would I be surprised? Maybe a little bit, you know. When I went to Claremont Men's College, their ROTC program had 3 people, and people protested. 5 people protesting 3 people was at the extent of our political activities.
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm thinking, like if your whole idea of like the military and what it means to be in the military has changed.
I mean, I find that there's a lot of extraordinary, brilliant people in the military, and then I find that there, you know, there's others, you know, the lifers, the guys who know, and there's people who are prepared to do, you know, full out, go, you know, do whatever they're told on that level. But yet they want to know, you know, I mean, it's a whole mixed bag for me because I've followed military history most of my life. I'm fascinated by it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, have you ever wanted to be in the military?
I have until my father explained to me that when he was on a carrier and it was hit by a kamikaze that they closed all the bulkhead doors and you're pretty much there on your own. And the dulce et decorum est doesn't last very long. And he explained, if you want to do this, understand that, you know, when things go down, you're on your own. And it's pretty ugly and very brutal. And, you know, men burn to death around you. And then when they're all clear sounds, they come in and pick up what's left. So it was like, you know, any ideas that it's glorious? No. But to realize that there are dedicated people there? Yes. To realize that there are cases where it's quite necessary that force is, you know, it's, if you watch Why We Fight with Eisenhower, you realize that here's a man leaving office saying, we have one thing to beware of, the military-industrial complex. And this is a man who took total responsibility for D-Day. He wrote a letter saying, if this invasion fails, I take total responsibility. I'd like to pass that letter on to W and just say, read this, compare and contrast, you know?
How did you deal with the draft in the 60s?
My draft number was 351. It meant the Viet Cong had to be coming from Kansas.
Oh, gee. So it was like not an issue for you? You were just out?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't an issue. So in a weird way, I won the lottery and it made the decision for me. If I'd been drafted, it would have been an interesting call. I don't know whether I would have gone or, you know, I don't think I would have fled to Canada. I think, you know, would I have gone? I would probably lean to probably saying yes, or be in a unit like W, you know, in a, you know, when he was in the same National Guard unit as Bigfoot, about the same number of sightings.
Were you a fan of Bob Hope when you were growing up and of his?
No, I mean, I watched his movies later on when I saw him, you know. It's crazy, isn't it? Here I am in Beirut, wild. It's one big sand trap. I can't imagine Brooke Shields in a burqa. All you'd see is an eyebrow. It's crazy. Look out. We're dropping Ann Coulter down just to see who flees. It's incredible. I think we've even violated the Geneva Convention by putting her anywhere in Iraq is a violation of the Geneva Convention. People are fleeing right there. Actually, some of the Iraqis are giving up. And how about this Zarqawi? Doesn't he look like Ron Jeremy? I'm telling you, it's crazy. I saw the autopsy photo, but that's that porn actor. It's Ron Jeremy. I don't think either one of them are happy about that connection. But wild, isn't it? It's loopy.
Very good. Very good.
Thank you. Thank you.
Robin Williams speaking with Terry Gross in 2006. We'll hear more in a moment. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and we're listening to Terry's 2006 interview with Robin Williams, who died yesterday at the age of 63.
Now, I know you were a big fan of Jonathan Winters. I have to tell you, I interviewed Jonathan Winters once, like in the late 1980s, and it was as if he were narrating a hallucination that he was having that I didn't see.
Oh, big time. Well, he's an artist, and plus he's also been medicated over the years, you know, and... The greatest part about Jonathan is he will create a world for you there. And that's why his records are so great. But if you see him in person, he transforms. He literally morphed before the technology exists. He was there doing that, and people were like, what? And he would jump in and out of these characters, multiple characters, and people were like, and you know, you're right. It is like all of a sudden you're going, and he'll drag you into that slowly but surely.
When did you become a fan of his?
When I saw my father laughing at him when he used to be on the old Tonight Show with Jack Parr.
Mm-hmm. And this is before you were
amazing.
Performing, and before
yeah,
you
that was it. He was doing this thing. He was like, he came on to Jack Parr, and he came in with a little pith helmet, saying, "I am a great white hunter. My name is Terence Fogarty." And he said, "What do you hunt?" "I hunt mainly squirrels." And Jack Parr said, "What do you do?" I said, "I aim for their little nuts." And you could see Jack Parr just go, "Oh, you know, it's." And a lot of these people are people he knows, you know, John, you know me. And people from the, from he calls the Happy Place, which was the institute they put him in. And he had the great thing when the time he had the kind of the breakdown, and he climbed the mast of the Balcuda, which is an old three-masted schooner that's in the bay in San Francisco docked, and he climbed it totally naked. And when they brought him down and the ambulance and the police were waiting, they said, "Mr. Winters, do you have anything to say?" He said, "Yes, never land alone." So, you know, you have a certain perspective there. The comedy comes from a deeper place.
Now, you mentioned that he genuinely had a breakdown. And I think it's true that a lot of comics have a very depressive side.
They have a dark side. I mean, because you're looking at that. You know, it's part of looking at, in the process of looking for comedy, you have to be deeply honest. And then doing that, you'll find out, here's the other side. You know, you'll be looking under the rock occasionally for the laughter. So they have a depressed side, but is it always the sad clown thing? No. But they're, I find comics to be pretty honest people in terms of looking at stuff from both sides, or all sides, and presenting you with, like, here it is, and like Lenny Bruce did the great thing about the white-collar drunk. Yeah, I'll kill you. He said, it's not like the sweet Clem Cadiddlehopper drunk like the Red Skull. Hello, buddy, hello. He's like, yeah, I'll kill you, and I'll kill your dog, too. That's the thing I'll do. Buddy, I tell you what, I love you, but I'll kill you. That's how much I love you.
Have you ever dealt with depressions? And I guess I'm wondering if
as a human being, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess I'm wondering if, like, your manic side,
It's not even manic. I mean, manic, that people sometimes, I volunteered to be on the cover of I think it was Newsweek for their issue on medication. Thank you. And when the guy said, "Well, do you ever get depressed?" I said, "Yeah, sometimes I get sad." I mean, you can't watch news for more than 3 seconds and go, "Oh, this is depressing." And then immediately, all of a sudden, they branded me manic depressive. I was like, that's clinical. I'm not that. Do I perform sometimes in a manic style? Yes. Am I manic all the time? No. Do I get sad? Oh, yeah. Does it hit me hard? Oh, yeah. Do you find a way? But does that immediately make me like, oh, good. Thanks, Terry. Nice talking with you. Oh, I don't know, Terry. I don't know. I don't get... Oh, I'm okay. I'm okay. Give me that. Can I borrow that? Oh, no. I'm all right. Thanks for asking that, Terry, because, yeah, I get depressed. I get depressed that I wasn't on American Idol. I could sing, you know.
So no clinical depression is what I'm taking away
no
from
No clinical
this.
Depression. No, am I... No, I'm. I get bummed, like I think a lot of us do at certain times. You look at the world and go, whoa. And then other moments you look and go, oh, things are okay. Oh, whoa.
I was also wondering if you were ever in psychotherapy. You know, again, you've played therapist, but I was wondering if you were ever in psychotherapy.
I was near it, yes. Yeah, I mean, no, actually, for years, yeah, still.
Yeah, because here's why I ask. First of all...
No, why do you ask? Because I'm not paranoid, but why do you ask?
Well, a few reasons. One is, like, as we were talking about, you know, as an actor, I think you have to have insights into how people operate in human psychology. Mm-hmm. But also, some people are so kind of verbally adept, like you are, that mm-hmm. I wonder if they're talk therapy proof, you know what I mean? Whether they're so skilled at using words to get around things in a way that, you know... Is it hard for them to be disarmed,
disarmed?
By language?
Well,
in,
you can
in a
disarm
therapist.
Yourself. You could lay down the arms, and basically that's the purpose of therapy. To a certain point, if you're just going in to say, hey, look, I can really shuck this guy, that's not the purpose, really. Eventually, at a certain point, you have to say, okay, what do you want to do? Why are you doing this? And, you know, at a certain point, you know, or get money back, you know, because the idea is to kind of get to the point of realizing where are the issues that you could... You know, confront yourself, which is, you know, the ideal, is to deal with that and come out the other side going, okay, I know now these are certain things that I do, and you wish to continue that way? Or, you know, like you said, if you can talk your way around it, then all you're doing is just kind of, you know, self-replicating. Okay, continue the behavior and never change. As the one therapist said, change is not a hobby, you know? And as the one guy at the suicide hotline said, life isn't for everybody. But, you know, that would be a rough one. Hey, like, hey, how you doing? Well, you know.
So you feel like you've gotten a lot out of psychotherapy?
Yeah, it's helped me over the years and really helped kind of, you know, a lot. I mean, I think enough to keep going and be able to say, you know, yeah, does it mean everything's wonderful? Am I all is working well, you know, it's going well for me. I feel good. And being governor has made me feel that, you know, as an immigrant, I came here to America with a dream and a vial of anabolic steroids, and look what happened. But, yeah, it's helped me. I would say it's done a lot more good than bad, and I have been able to be disarmed on that level. But there's other times in the beginning where, you know, yeah, sure, okay, talk your way out of it. But a good therapist will kind of say, okay, this is not staged. Or as a friend, I guess, I heard somebody said, you used to go to AA just for stage time, and that's not it.
Can we talk about your voice for a minute? You're able to do so many voices, so many different styles of speaking and accents mm-hmm. and so on. Did you work on that? Is that something you just kind of intuitively had, or is that like a craft that you've...
Well, initially, I had to overcome this. But
no, I didn't work on it. I think it just happened to be fun. I mean, I have people would say, kind of an eidetic ear to be able to do that and speak French and speak Russian. I mean, not as much Russian as I speak French. And even when I speak French in Paris, they're going, don't try, I speak English. And then she gives a cigarette to a baby. But it is the idea of just hearing it and kind of being able to assimilate that. I guess I was just acoustically, you know, given that ability. So don't work on it. It just seems to come out pretty naturally.
Do you sing?
I can. And I'm hoping to be on Broadway for Brokeback Mountain, the musical. I have a song, Can't Quit You, Innes. I know. As I hold you outside, there's snow, and I feel that glow as I hold you down below. And we'll stop right there because I know that when I accept the Tony, I want to thank my partner, Tom, and things you don't hear at the Tony, don't wait up for me, kids. But, you know, those are the things that I love about musicals. They're great. I can sing, but it tends to be more like Ethel Merman.
I go for the big numbers, like in Aladdin, which is like Ethel Merman.
Yeah.
Hello, young lovers. And, you know, even then, right now, your engineer went, tell him do not do that. But it's a good thing.
Yeah, because I figure people who can imitate voices and do accents and stuff like that could probably get notes too, you know, be on pitch.
Yes, they could get notes. Yes, little notes like call me. Signed, who is this? Signed Maria. Maria who? Callous, you fool. Yes, I could get notes. I mean, there is a pitch to even any voice, just an accent. And in Mandarin, you say, she, she. Oh, you go, now, it's okay. You can be the difference between ordering a car and saying, please play with my buttocks. You know, that's the difference in tone. And that's actually not a real Mandarin phrase. So for those listening, it's okay.
Can I make a confession?
Yes.
Yes.
You're not wearing anything, but that's okay. You're in the radio studio, and if you're in a thong, that's wonderful. A thong in your heart, that's okay. No, please, confess.
Well, before we did the interview, I had no idea what to expect, and I wasn't sure you'd give me a straight answer to anything. And I just want to say thank you for actually having a talk.
Well, it's good to talk
and
that.
And for being really funny at the same time.
Well, that's probably what life is. You know, you can do both. You can talk and be funny. And you see, it wasn't that zany. It was just conversation. It's a good thing, Terry. You know that.
It's a good thing.
It's a good thing, as Martha Stewart said once she got out of prison. You know, she had that wonderful magazine she published while she was in jail called Truly Inside Living, which was wonderful. How to make Trump doy with a lovely toothbrush. Things to do with a shiv. Besides stab, you know, wonderful things. And if you only have one window, use the light. She is very good that way. And you call this Chev, you know.
Robin Williams,
we'll be right
thank
back
so
with
much.
Some people from New... Oh, you're welcome, Terry Gross. We're here with some people from New Zealand who are talking about animal husbandry. And can you marry a ewe? Your call. Your lines are open. easy. Terrence, no. How was it? Not bad. All right, thank you. We're back. Thanks, Terry. It was a good day. It was a good day. Good on you, Terry. Take care of yourself. We'll be right back with Ann Coulter just to talk about, well, euthanasia. We'll be going. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Robin Williams speaking with Terry Gross in 2006. Williams died yesterday in an apparent suicide. He was 63. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews a funny new novel about academia called Dear Committee Members. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Julie Schumacher's first novel, The Body is Water, was a finalist for the Penn Hemingway Award. She's a faculty member in the creative writing program at the University of Minnesota, a job that presumably gave her some raw material for her new academic farce, Dear Committee Members. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has this review.
For all you teachers out there contemplating the August calendar with dismay, watching, powerless, as the days of summer vacation dwindle down to a precious few, I have some consolation to offer. A hilarious academic novel that'll send you laughing, albeit ruefully, back into the trenches of the classroom. Julie Schumacher's novel is called Dear Committee Members, and one of the reasons why it's such a mordant minor masterpiece is the fact that Schumacher had the brainstorm to structure it as an epistolary novel. This book of letters is composed of a year's worth of recommendations that our antihero, a weary professor of creative writing and literature, is called upon to write for junior colleagues, lackluster students, and even former lovers. The gem of a law school recommendation letter, our beleaguered professor writes for a cutthroat undergrad who he's known for all of 11 minutes, is alone worth the price of Schumacher's book. Our professor, Jason Fitger, was once a promising novelist, but his career fizzled when he returned to the well of his failed marriages and affairs for story material a few too many times. Now in late middle age, Professor Fitger finds himself stuck in the intellectual Sargasso Sea of the undistinguished Payne University. The English department where he teaches, like real-life English departments everywhere, is hemorrhaging students who are pragmatically choosing to major in disciplines like international finance and computer science. Indeed, while in the classroom teaching his scant remaining creative writing students, all of whom are intent on cranking out gory sci-fi epics, Fitger must put up with the sound of wrecking balls and clouds of particulate matter stirred up by construction crews busy remodeling the already swanky economics department upstairs. As Fitger discloses in a ranting aside within one of his recommendation letters, his own dank office is situated conveniently adjacent to the men's room, so that my writing and research are invariably conducted to the flushing of waste. Schumacher has a sharp ear for the self-pitying eloquence peculiar to academics like the fictional Fitger, who feel that their genius has never gotten its due. His resentment seeps out between the lines of the recommendation letters he relentlessly writes or ineptly fills out on computerized questionnaires, urging RV parks and paintball emporiums to hire his graduating English majors for entry-level management positions. Inventive as all these letters are, Schumacher is smart enough to sidestep the danger posed by the inherently static form of a collection of letters. Instead, as Fitger's recommendation letters grow more elaborately unhinged, we learn more about his background and his character develops beyond the one-note academic burnout case. Dear Committee Members serves up the traditional comic situations of classic academic farces like David Lodge's Small World and Kingsley Amis's immortal Lucky Jim. But it also updates the genre to include newer forms of indignity within the halls of academe. Take, for instance, this gem of a recommendation Fitger writes on behalf of a young colleague applying for a teaching position in comp rhetoric at another college. Alex Ruffel has prevailed upon me to support his teaching application to your department, which, I gather, is hiring adjunct faculty members exclusively, bypassing the tenure track with its attendant health benefits, job security, and salaries on which a human being might reasonably live. Perhaps your institution should cut to the chase and put its entire curriculum online, thereby sparing Ruffel the need to move. You could prop him up in a broom closet in his apartment, poke him with the butt end of a mop when you need him to cough up a lecture on Caribbean fiction or the passive voice, and then charge your students $1,000 each to correct the essays their classmates have downloaded from a website. Such is the future of education. Like the best works of farce, academic or otherwise, Dear Committee Members deftly mixes comedy with social criticism and righteous outrage. By the end, you may well find yourself laughing so hard it hurts.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University and is the author of the forthcoming book, So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. She reviewed Dear Committee Members by Julie Schumacher. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Adam Stanishevsky. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Zillow, with homes for sale, historical pricing data, and photos available on Zillow.com or on their mobile apps. Zillow, find your way home. From Viking River Cruises, exploring the world in comfort, offering European cruises on Viking longships. More at vrc.com/radio. And from Sit for Life and Herman Miller, featuring the Aeron chair, including the true black color. Sit for Less is now sitforlife.com. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Jonathan Weissman, who covers Congress for the New York Times.
This is a Congress that really is doing nothing.
Weissman says by all measurements, laws passed, days in session, issues dealt with, this sharply divided Congress is the least productive in history. Join us.